On the show today, how we experience time. So music is all about keeping time. The beats within a measure, every full, half, quarter note. It's also about the timing of a bass note, the rhythm of the percussion, the pulse of a chord progression as it dances with the melody. And when all of these elements come together, you get a cohesive sound, and it can have a transportive effect.
I stand on the podium, conduct a two-hour concert. It feels like 2 minutes.
This is Robert Franz, the music director of the Windsor Symphony Orchestra in Ontario, Canada. Even as a kid, Robert found himself entranced by music. He remembers his teacher giving him a recording of Dvorak's Cello Concerto.
And I used to sit and listen to the first side, A side, first movement, over and over again. And I'd sit on the side of my bed, and I'd imagine I was the one playing the concerto. And out my window, we had a birch tree, and the leaves would blow in the wind. And it looked like people were applauding for me.
I love that. You were the star of your own show. That's so great.
I had the whole thing. I had the audience. I had the concerto. I had everything was done.
That's great. So not everybody feels as enthralled, shall we say, by classical music. What are some of the things that you hear from people who maybe just don't get it?
Well, it's complicated. It's fancy. It's boring. It's just not something that some people are used to like engaging with. And I think part of it, Manoush, is that when you think about classical music, you think about going to a hall and hearing an orchestra play an hour-long symphony, let's say. Well, that's a lot different than a three-minute rock tune on the radio that you sort of bang your head with as you're driving down the road. That's a totally different experience.
Robert has spent his career helping people better connect with classical music, and he's developed a listening toolkit for audiences, one that will likely alter the way you experience time and music, too. Here's Robert Franz on the TED stage.
I come from a family of music lovers, but not classically trained musicians. And so whenever we would go to a concert, it would be kind of an exciting event. My dad, Bob, his name is Bob, you know, he's kind of curious, like, well, what's this going to be like? So we were on a trip one day to a concert, and I said to him, I said, so today the concert is going to feature a world premiere of a brand new symphony, a symphony that lasts about 30 minutes or so. And he's like, oh, 30 minutes. What should I listen for? I was like, what a great question. Thank you for engaging with me in that way, right? My dad and I are like having a conversation about how to listen to classical music. So I said, okay, Dad, I'm going to give you four tools to use while you're listening. I call them Bob's four tools. So I said, here's how these tools work. They're kind of like screens that you would hold up, you know, on a window, but you hold them up over your ear and you listen using these tools and these screens. And as you listen and adjust, if you find that one of them isn't working, lay it down without judgment and pick up another one and continue to go back and forth between these four tools and these four screens.
Okay, so Bob's four tools for engaging with classical music are rhythm, melody, texture, and visuals. Robert, walk us through each one of these, starting with the first one, rhythm.
Sure. So these are basic elements in music. And when a composer writes a rhythm, there are basically two options. The first option is that the composer writes the rhythm that kind of goes along with your heartbeat, that maybe slows your heartbeat down or speeds your heartbeat up, but works in tandem with your heartbeat. And so that's one option. The other option is that a composer can write a rhythm that goes against your heartbeat and makes you feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so having those two options, it's not about which you like or don't like. It's just about what is present in front of you. So I said to my dad, I said, listen to the rhythm and decide if the rhythm is with your heartbeat or against your heartbeat. And that will sort of give you an indication of why you're reacting the way you are to the rhythm that you're hearing.
Okay, we're going to play a little bit of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto number 1. I I find this very energizing. It gives me, like, I'm like, let's go.
So let me tell you why that is, Manoush. The pulse of this is somewhere between 96 and 100 beats per minute. If you relate that to your heart rate, that is a kind of a high heart rate.
Uh-huh.
A resting heart rate is 60 or 70 per minute, right? And so if you're at 96 or 100, it's going, but it's really kind of pumping. It's almost like you're running. And that's the pulse. And so it's taking your heart rate and it's like replicating it almost.
That's so great. It makes me want to move. It makes me want to move fast. I'm like ready to take on the world with that.
Sometimes when I'm driving down the road and I'm listening to music on the radio, if the pulse gets higher, my foot will get a little heavier on the gas pedal and I'll go a little faster, just not knowing it.
Sorry, officer. It was just Bach.
That's exactly right. Yeah, Bach did
it. I love it. Okay, so that piece matches your heartbeat. Okay, we're going to listen to now something you suggested that's a little bit different. It's Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which has a different effect. This one kind of stops me in my tracks, actually. I'm like, what is going on?
That's exactly right. So the rhythm is so disjunct, and it's actually the sacrificial dance from the Rite of Spring. So it's really the climax of the entire ballet. Mm. And in it, we get a sense of real discord and real uncomfortableness. You can feel it sort of pushing against your own natural body rhythm. And that's what I'm talking about. And so you don't have to say to yourself, oh, I don't like that. Just observe what it is. And then you say, oh, okay, that's why I felt the way I did. That's kind of cool. And I mean, I know many people have seen this, right, and heard the Rite of Spring performed live. And yes, it's disjunct and it goes against your heartbeat, but it's incredibly exciting because of the chaos.
In a minute, more of Bob's tools and how active listening can shape our sense of time. We'll talk about Tchaikovsky's iconic melodies, Debussy's soundscapes, and even hear a little Sinatra. On the show today, how we perceive time. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Back in a sec. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, how we perceive time. And we were just talking to conductor Robert Franz about Bob's four tools. This is a set of active listening tools to better understand and enjoy classical music. So we heard about the first tool, rhythm. Robert explains the second tool from the TED stage.
The second tool is melody. Now, we think of a melody as a tune that you can sing, and that's very much a standard kind of concept of how a melody works. You know, you think about it in a church setting where the alto, the tenor, and the bass parts sing the accompaniment, and the soprano sings the melody along the top line. Well, there was probably nobody in the history of all melody writing who wrote more beautiful melodies than the Russian composer Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. And in his Fifth Symphony, in the second movement, there is a solo for the French horn that begins this movement and is unbelievably beautiful and really quite singable as a melody.
It's so beautiful. It's one of the middle instruments. It's incredible. Now, it's so musical, though. It's so tuneful. It's so vocal that Frank Sinatra borrowed it for one of his big hits, Moon Love.
I never made that connection until I saw your TED Talk. I was like, oh, yeah, they do sound the same.
They're exactly the same.
Will this be Moon Love? Nothing but Moon Love.
what a good melody does is it takes you from the beginning, it captures you, and then it moves you through time. I mean, think about it this way. Music is architecture in time, not in space, but in time. A composer like Beethoven, for instance, would, in an angstful way, spend days and days and days deciding what the next note should be. Finally, he'd land on the note that would propel the melody forward.
So what are the qualities that you're listening for when you are dissecting a melody?
So the first and most important thing is that a melody has to have a beginning and a middle and an end. There has to be kind of an arc to the melody. Tchaikovsky was one of those composers that could write melodies that people would remember forever. People were just smitten with whatever the newest Tchaikovsky melody was. So people would come here, like, say, the world premiere of his Fifth Symphony, and would think, okay, what's the big melody going to be? I can't wait to hear what it is. And of course, it was just arresting to the audience the very first time.
Okay, now we're going to something a slightly more abstract. If melody was clear and really holding your hand, texture is the third, right?
Yes, yes. In the music world, we think of this as harmony. But if you think about it in a more sort of visual way, each instrument plays a note. That note has a certain timbre or color. Mm. When those colors blend together, they form a different color. As those notes change, those colors change. So it becomes a vibrant tapestry that is actually almost alive and is constantly changing. It's kind of like when you're a kid and you take one of those big parachutes and you are all waving it and the colors keep changing. Uh-huh. It's that exact same concept.
Okay, so let's put Bob's third tool to use with the second movement of Debussy's The Sea, Play of the Waves. Would it be too simplistic to say, Robert, that Debussy is creating kind of a vibe, as the kids would say?
Not at all. In fact, what I call it is a soundscape, which isn't actually a real word, but it sort of describes the idea of a world that is created through sound. Mm-hmm. A composer is, instead of like focusing on melody or rhythm, they're really just trying to create a sound world for you to be in, one that sort of changes. Now, Debussy was an impressionistic composer, much like an impressionistic painter. He would write music that took little sort of dots of sound, and he would stitch them together and form these sort of larger color palettes. I will tell you that if you look at the score to La Mer or The Sea by Debussy, this piece, if you look at the score, it's really quite complex on the page. But when you back away from it and you get away from all those details, all of a sudden the big shapes become enormously clear. That's why this piece is so popular with audiences, because they can see and almost in their imagination smell and feel the sea air against their face.
So for the last of the tools that you've concocted for your dad, Bob, you recommended that he watch the orchestra. Obviously, we can't do that right now. But what should people look for when they're at a concert?
So I'll tell you a story that exemplifies this.
Okay.
I did not grow up watching or playing hockey, which is incredibly sacrilegious now that I live in Canada. But I remember my first professional hockey game as an adult. I was incredibly taken with the nonverbal communication that I saw going on between the players on the ice, how they sort of moved back and forth and were aware completely of where the puck was and where each other was and what the other was doing. I was mesmerized for hours as I watched this intense sort of back and forth. That's the same kind of feeling that I get when I sit and watch an orchestra perform in a hall. You're looking at 80 or 90 people on stage, incredibly talented, creative people who all have their own opinions about how the music should go, but they're up there working as this enormous team. Mm. So for instance, the string family, you know, they all their bows are moving in the same direction at the same time. Well, that is pre-planned, and it's pre-planned to create a sense of unification in the sound. But that really is something that they are paying attention to. What part of the bow are they using? How fast or slow is the bow as they use it? Percussion family is another interesting group of people on stage because they have so many different instruments, and the way they coordinate from one side to the other is really pretty extraordinary. There's so much nonverbal communication going on between the musicians and between the musicians and the conductor. And I think all of those elements are really important components to experiencing orchestral music live.
We wanted to have you here because this whole episode is about how we perceive time. And I guess with that framing, how does what you just told me sort of play into it? Because it's very powerful.
What I can tell you is that at the end of the concert, my dad came backstage and I said to him, "Hey, what'd you think?" He goes, "It was good. It was really good." I said, "Okay, did you like the piece?" He goes, "Yeah, the only problem was it was too short." I said, "Well, Dad, it was a 30-minute piece." He said, "Yeah, but I just worked through all four of your tools and the piece was over."
My dad was so engaged with his active listening to classical music that he didn't even pay attention to the amount of time that had taken place. He was more curious about what actually was happening on the stage. Now take for a second this idea and imagine what would happen if we all spent more time listening than speaking and engaging with what we heard and really noticing our soundscape and our world around us. Active listening is the key to so many great, great challenges that we face. But most importantly, when you go into that concert hall and hear that orchestra play, bring a sense of curiosity and those active listening skills, and boom, away you'll go.
That was Robert Franz. He is the music director of the Windsor Symphony Orchestra in Ontario. You can see his full talk at TED.com.